Hello, my name is Joshua Ray. I'm 12 years old. Today is February 3rd, 2018, and I'm speaking with Stuart Skidrum Waddles, who's my grandfather. We're recording this interview in Seattle, Washington. And yeah, so where did your family originate before you were born? Where were they before?
Both my mother and my father were in New York City when they met. My mother was half French, so her French, she was a, her father, my grandfather was French, from an area of France called the Vosges, and my father's father was a second generation immigrant in New York. They landed in New York. They came from Russia. They landed in New York.
Okay. That's very interesting. So, where were you born?
I was born in New York City, Doctor's Hospital in New York City on the Upper East Side.
Nice. How long were you in New York City? Because I know you spent some time in Austria and Italy.
That's right. So I grew up mostly in New York City, but when I was 9 years old, we moved to Vienna, Austria, and we were there for 3 years. At that point, my birth father was deceased. He died when I was six, and my mother remarried a man named Gurdon Waddles. That's where the Skadron and the Waddles come from. My first father was Eugene Skadron, and my stepfather was Gurdon Waddles, and he was working for the United Nations, and so he got posted to Vienna. He was loaned to Vienna. He was loaned to the International Atomic Energy Agency, which was just being set up at the time, and he helped set it up. He was the general counsel for the International Atomic Energy Agency, which was headquartered in Vienna. Not officially under the UN, but sort of affiliated with the United Nations, so he was loaned to the International Atomic Energy Agency. And we moved to Vienna at that point when I was nine, my brother was seven.
So what was that like? Vienna, what was moving there like?
Well,
was it scary?
Yeah, not really scary. It was 1958. Vienna was still rebuilding after World War II. It was very slow to rebuild. But most of the city was there or rebuilt, and they were still working on it. It wasn't scary at all from the point of view of the city wasn't scary, but the process for a nine-year-old to just move like that to another foreign country, that
That's
was kind of scary.
Scary.
So
That's
my my
really scary.
I remember my stepfather came up and sat down. My brother and I shared a room, and he came up and sat down in our room, and he said we were about to go to bed, and he said, "I have some news for you. We're moving to Vienna, Austria." And we had no idea where Vienna was. I mean, we didn't know where Austria was, really. I mean, we had an idea. We knew it was in Europe. But he showed us on the globe, because we had a globe.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed us on the globe where Vienna was. And we said, "How long are we going to be there?" And he said, "Well, it's a diplomatic posting. For right now, it's 3 years. But we don't know how long it will be. It could be longer." So we went to Vienna, I remember we went, my mother packing all of these. We leased our house in New York City. We owned a home in New York City, and on 89th Street. And I remember my mother packing these huge trunks to move, because my stepfather went ahead to start the work. And then we were going to move after the school year was over.
Makes sense.
So we, so because I think this was in the spring, was it in the spring? No. We were going to move after the first semester because when we got to Vienna, school was still in session. This is part of the story. So we, I remember my mother packing these huge trunks and packing up the house, you know, so that we could rent it out. And then we left and we sailed across the Atlantic, because that's what you did then. You either, especially if you had a lot of luggage, you sailed across the Atlantic.
Like a big, like, steamboat.
Yeah.
That sounds awesome and scary. Was there any, like, storms or something?
No, there were no storms, but when we got on, the boat really started my brother's and my education. And my younger brother, Josh, is 2 years younger than I am.
Well, because you had no idea how to speak this language.
Well, at the time, everybody spoke English on the boat. That was fine. We sailed on the French lines. We actually sailed on the Liberté, which was, a couple of years later, was decommissioned. But it used to be a troop ship during the war. And the Liberté was one of the prime ships of the French line. So we sailed on the French line, and as soon as we got on board, as soon as we got pulled out from the harbor, my mother became very seasick and stayed in her cabin the entire time. And so my brother and I were on our own. And the cabin steward kind of took care of us and made sure we got the meals and that kind of thing. But pretty soon everything went well. And we started to learn that things were a little bit different, because at one point, I think it was the second or the third day there, the cabin steward said to us, we were traveling in cabin class, and there's a first class and a cabin class, and then there's a steerage class.
You might have told me this story.
Yeah, and so we were there, and the steward, I think the second or the third day, the steward could see that my brother and I were going to look nuts, and he said, I'm going to tell you a secret. And he took us to this padded door that was at the end of the corridor. I thought it was just the end of the corridor. And it had a little aluminum disc in it with a slot. And he took out a 1-franc piece, which was aluminum at the time, and big. He took out a 1-franc piece from his pocket, and he put it into the disc, and he turned the disc, and then he opened up a door, because that's what it was. It was a lock to a door, even though it looked like a wall. And he said, he looked at us and he said, "Gentlemen, this is first class." And then he handed us each a 1-franc piece, and he said, "Spend your day here if you want. You can probably have lunch there, but you need to be back by dinner time, and you need to have dinner in cabin class seating." And we went, okay. And we went into first class. And from that day on, we went into first class the whole time. My brother entered the ping pong tournament that was in first class, and he won, but he couldn't pick up his prize because they would know that he was not from first class. So already we were playing like spies. It was kind of fun. That was the crossing. When we got to Vienna, I mean, first we landed at Le Havre, and we went to Paris, and from Paris we went to Vienna by train. And when we got to Vienna, it was just totally strange to us. I mean, we'd never visited a European city before. We had no idea what it was like. They're very different from U.S. cities.
Well, yeah, because they have, like, you know, thousands of more, they have, like, so much more history.
Yes, right. And so there was that. And then there was a search for schools. And after a couple of weeks, my mother decided that, I don't think it was even that long, but I think we'd been in Vienna a couple of weeks. And it was weird because there nobody spoke our language.
Oh yeah.
And we didn't speak their language, which was German or Austrian, really, just a form of German,
yeah.
And
is not very hard to learn.
So German is not very hard to learn?
Well, the basics.
The syntax is totally different from English. I was 9 years old. The syntax was totally different from English.
Well,
it was very difficult to deal with. And we weren't, you know, there was, I mean, we, my brother and I, At that point, my mother said, well, I've gone to the Anglo-American school that's here in Vienna. Because we had asked, what are we going to do for schooling? And they said, oh, there's an English school in Vienna. It's going to be fine. And when we got there, she went to the school. She didn't like it. She wanted us to go to the French lycée. So the lycée system is a system that was established of French schools in every capital of the world. And it was founded by Napoleon Bonaparte, who wanted French diplomats to be able to school their kids in French. At the time, too, French was the language that everybody spoke diplomatically. It was what's called the lingua franca. That's the language of choice for people to communicate with one another. So if you were an African, you learned French so that you could speak in a diplomatic way with somebody from even the United States, or certainly from anywhere in Europe. So a German would have to learn French in order to be a diplomat. So it was the lingua franca of the day, although that was disappearing. English was taking its place, but at the time, that's what it was. And Bonaparte established these French schools all over the world. And the concept of the lycée was, it was so regimented and so regular that you could actually step out of a class in Vienna and fly to Shanghai and step into the class the next day and be on the same page of the text and be learning exactly the same things.
That's extremely regulated.
Extremely regulated, and they actually had a system of inspectors who came from Paris and went all over the world to these various schools to make sure that they were keeping up those standards.
And Napoleon set this all up?
Yep. So anyway, when my brother and I walked into the lycée.
Quick question. Did you guys speak French?
No, we didn't speak any French. We didn't speak any German. We only spoke American.
English.
Well, it was American, because we found out pretty quickly that the English-speaking people in Vienna spoke differently than we did.
Yes.
So it was a really weird thing. My brother and I went to the lycée, and the lycée basically told my mother, we're not going to help these guys at all. They come in, they have to survive on their own. We're not going to give them special classes. There's no sort of French as a second language. There's German as a second language. We had to take that course, which was okay, except that they explained everything in French. And for weeks we walked around this school. We sat in class. Kids were laughing at us, you know. Recess was our favorite place, because at recess there were other diplomats there, other diplomats' kids there who were American or English, and they would speak with us and give us some idea about what was going on. But there was nobody else in my class who spoke English. And I was just sitting there, and they would laugh at me when I did things wrong, and everything was different. For instance, we had little slates for mathematics. Mathematics became my best subject, and it was my worst subject when I was in the United States. Because she would write the problems on the board, and we had to write the solutions on our little slates in chalk, and then hold it up. And so that was easy, because I didn't need words. It was pretty clear what was going on. A plus is a plus and a minus is a minus, no matter what language you're in, and a times is a times, and you know, and a division is a division. Although they did it a little bit differently in terms of the notation, but I figured it out. So that was that. My brother and I cried ourselves to sleep for 2 weeks. We would be exhausted. We would be tired of being picked on. We didn't know how we were gonna. There were exams too. We had to pass the exams. If we didn't pass the exams, my brother had already been put back a grade. And if he didn't pass his exams, he wasn't going to go on to the next grade, which would have been the grade that he had already done. And I was okay, but it was the same thing. If I didn't pass the exams, I wasn't going to the next. Well, I was going to have to stay in the same class. So my mother got us a governess who was trilingual. She spoke English, she spoke French, she spoke German. And every day we would come back from school and she would greet us. Madame von Fleck was her name. And Madame von Fleck would greet us and she would immediately start debriefing us. Our teachers sometimes would write down the pages of homework so that we knew what they were. But usually they just pointed to them and we had to figure it out. And Madame von Fleck first started with my brother because his memory wasn't as good as mine, and then with me to find out what it was that we had to study for the next day. And she taught us French and German, enough French and German to survive and pass the exams. And by the time we were done with Madame von Fleck, we were fluent in both French and German, and we knew what we were doing. So that was that.
So that's
was,
that's how you learned French and.
That's how I learned my French. That's how I learned my German. And also, I mean, we played with kids in German, you know. So then, we would summer in Italy, and that's where Joshua and I learned Italian. And we taught ourselves Italian. We just went down to the docks and played with the kids in the village. I took a guitar. I had a guitar at the time, and we would play American folk songs, and they loved that. And so we would, you know, people came around and talked to us and said, you know, who are you? And we told them who we were, and I learned Mi chiama, and Mi chiamo, and all those kinds of things that you would learn to kind of just get along. So by the end of the summer, we spoke Italian. So that's how we got our Italian.
That's interesting. And then you taught yourself Spanish, like just on your own. Because I remember as a young child watching you on your computer taking an online Spanish course.
Yes, and that was for work. I had made a commitment. I joined a nonprofit that was working in Central America, and I'd made a commitment to learn Spanish so that I could lead tours down there, and that's what I did. That was one way I did it. I mean, when I was here in Seattle, I was using Rosetta Stone, you know, to learn Spanish. But then very quickly, I was just picking it up as I was going, because it's a Romance language. It's a lot like Italian. so there was a little like French, and it's got a lot of the different Romance
languages.
Well,
they're all from like Latin and Greek roots, and
that's
so
right.
there's a lot of cognates.
Mm-hmm.
That's why French
that's
is
right.
so easy for me.
This was before I learned my Latin and Greek, though, so.
But still, cognates. Helpful. So that was interesting. I have a question going, like, back to when did you come here? Back here. And why?
Back here being the United States?
Yes. Because it sounds like you lived your childhood just spending summers in Italy. And
well, that was 3 years, and then we moved back. At a certain point, my stepfather's work at the International Atomic Energy Agency was done, and we moved back. When we moved back, we sailed from Italy, which was weird. But I mean, we were in Italy. We spent the summer in Italy, and then we got on the boat. We got on the Italian line on Leonardo da Vinci, for a pretty new boat at the time, in Naples, and we sailed back to New York. And then when we got back to New York, one of the things that happened with us was that because my brother and I spoke at that point more languages than our parents did, and we were fluent in those languages, we developed our own way of talking. We developed this sort of what you would call a patois, where we would start a sentence in English and then maybe grab a French word or two, and then finish the entire sentence in German, or add an Italian word, you know. It was just sort of whatever was coming to mind. And we understood one another. That's how we spoke. So
sounds
we...
Sounds like a great way to keep secrets from your parents.
Well, sort of, but they could pick it up. They knew enough to know what we were saying. But my father, my stepfather grew in increasingly disturbed as he knew that we were leaving and going back to the United States, because he didn't think that we would be able to survive, especially my brother, whose English was terrible at this point, especially in writing. And so he set down the law at the table. Whenever we were at the dining room table, we had whatever languages we used, we had to start and end in the same language. And I think he was trying to make sure that we would actually make a sentence that made sense in one language. So if we were going to start in German, we had to finish in German, no matter what languages we visited along the way. And it didn't do much good, because when we got to the United States, it was pretty clear that especially my brother, were not going to survive going back. We couldn't go back to the school where we were, the American school where we were. And so we went to the French Lycée. So for 2 years, I was at the French Lycée, my brother for three. I was at the French Lycée in New York, which is weird because you're back in your home country where you speak the language and everybody around you is speaking that language, but you're taking instruction in French because that's the kind of person you become. I think it was at that point when we came back that I started to realize how different my life was and how different my brother's life was from having been in Europe. And the things that we saw in Europe also affected us deeply. So, I mean, you grow up in the United States. The United States has never been attacked by a foreign power. It's never had...
It has been once.
Okay, but it's never been occupied.
Yeah, fair enough.
And so it's been attacked by a foreign power, but it hasn't been occupied. You know, even the Canadians, we kicked them back out. But it was a total eye-opening experience to live in a country where there were refugees. And this is 1958. The Iron Curtain is in force. Vienna sits on the border of, you know, Vienna sits very close to Hungary, to the border with Hungary. And communists were ruling Hungary at the time. The Soviet Union was the Soviet Union. It was a Soviet. It was filled, you know, all kinds of different countries that had kind of come into its orbit. And Vienna was filled with spies because people were going back and forth into Hungary. And Vienna was still rebuilding after the war. We could still see ruins. You know, it was just really eye-opening. We had people who were refugees from Hungary would come and work for us, you know, as domestic help in our home. We'd meet people all the time who had been kicked out of their country, brilliant engineers who were, you know, waiting to see if they could get a visa to the United States or some other country.
Speaking of visas and stuff, so you went to all of these countries. So that means you crossed a lot of international borders.
Yeah.
Did you have like a global entry or just a passport?
So we just had our American passports, but my stepfather had a UN laissez-passer, which is like a passport, but...
It's like a global entry, basically, for all the countries that support the UN.
Yes, it means that you're forbidden. They can't examine your baggage. They can't refuse you entry. If they're a signatory to the United Nations, they have to let you in, and they can't detain you. And they don't search your bags, and you're not liable for all the customs laws and all that kind of stuff if you're traveling on business with the UN. we just had our US passports, and so that was interesting, but we had diplomatic immunity. And diplomatic immunity meant that Vienna, in order to attract the International Atomic Energy Agency, promised that all the top executives at the IAEA would have diplomatic immunity, and that extended to their families. So they couldn't arrest us for a crime that committed in Austria or Italy or, you know, any other country we visited, France or England.
That didn't mean you did it, of course.
No, of course not. But... Yeah. My mother made very sure that we understood that we couldn't abuse this privilege, that we really needed to be
respected
with
it.
I remember one I remember at one point.
Oh, this sounds like a story.
We had a dog, a whippet, and we got in England, and we brought it to Vienna with us. And
you never told me that you went to England.
Yeah, we visited. My mother visited England to pick up the whippet and brought it back, and we visited England at the time too. And we had friends in England and relatives in England. So we were in the park. We were in one of the parks in Vienna, and the dog was doing something that it wasn't supposed to do, and one of the policemen pointed it out to my mother, and my mother said, "Aber das ist ein diplomatischer Hund." That's a diplomatic dog. As though, you know, that meant that Chloe could go to the bathroom anywhere she wanted because she was a diplomatic dog. It made no sense whatsoever. So my mother actually said that. She was, but we lived a different life in Vienna. I mean, we had a chauffeur.
But hold on. What did the policeman do after that?
Oh, he said, "Entschuldigen, gnädige Frau, I'm sorry. I apologize." And walked away.
That's interesting. I'm trying to learn German right now, so I can understand like maybe two of the words that you've said.
Which maybe. Ones did you understand?
Frau. So.
And?
I think that's the only one.
You should learn Entschuldigen because it means I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Very useful. A very useful word when you're learning a language.
Je suis désolé.
I didn't mean to insult your sister, sir.
Je suis désolé. I'm sorry.
Je suis désolé, yes, in French, yeah.
I can do French pretty well.
Good.
Actually, one of my teachers came up with this thing called taxi language.
Yes.
Which is basically, if you can get a taxi in a foreign language, it's like a status of where you are at the language. If you can get a taxi, tell it where to go, like only using that language, you're all good.
Yeah, that's about a quarter of the business language course. That's what your business language is like that. If you learn enough language to do business, right? Not enough to read a novel or discuss literature, but enough language to do business, you know, you can get by traveling to another country. You can deal with customs, you can deal with taxis, you can deal with how much is the bus, you can do all of that kind of thing.
That's interesting. So, tell me a story, because you once told me a story about you were on the train ride with your mother and your brother, and your brother cut his hand on it.
Yes.
What was that? Correct me if I'm wrong, but that sounds like it was the train ride.
This is a hysterically tragic train story. It's funny and it's sad.
So, was that the train ride from the Paris to Austria?
No, we were traveling. We were traveling actually from Italy, and we had to cross into Hungary briefly in order to get to Vienna. Now there were no. I can't remember whether there were stops in Hungary or not. I don't think there were. But that didn't stop the border police from demanding that everybody produce their passports. And so the train stopped basically in a field. And the border police got on and went from car to car, you know, asking for everybody's passports. And my mother lived in terror of this because she's going, "We're in a communist country. They have the right to detain us if they want to. We have U.S. passports, and my husband, who has diplomatic immunity, is not traveling with us." So it was, you know, it was my wife. I mean, it was my mother. It was my brother. I think we had our governess with us. We may have had one other person with us who was traveling. But at this point, it was just my mother and my brother and myself who were in the in in one of the cabins of the train. And my brother and I had had been playing around, and we've been running around, and we were running in between the cars, which is something that I wouldn't let somebody my age do now, but yeah, the age that I was then, I wouldn't let them do it. But that's what we were doing. We were running around, and these doors are sliding doors, and they're on a lot of pressure to close. They close right away. And my brother caught his hand in one of the doors. My brother to this day says it was my fault that I actually slammed the door, but I don't believe it. At any rate, he cut his hand pretty badly. And then this train started slowing down, and we thought, oh shit, what did we do? So we ran back to, you know, we went back to, and my brother's crying, and you know, there's blood all over. And so he runs back to the cabin, and I run back to the train compartment where we are, and we go back to the train compartment, and my mother says, "What happened?" She's furious with us. Also, she's very nervous about the border police, and she said, "We're about to be boarded by the Hungarian police, and you need to understand what this means." And she gave us this long lecture about it. She said, "They're going to come in here, and they're going to ask questions, and you need to be quiet." My brother was like, and she was saying, "You need to be quiet. I need you quiet." She wrapped his hand in a handkerchief, put it into his jacket, right? And my brother is sitting there like this, pale, shaking, not wanting to say a word, right? And when the border police open the door, you know, my brother is like terrified, and I'm like, terrified too, and they, you know, they ask for our passports, and my mother hands over the passports, and they look them over, and they say, "Okay." And my mother said, you know, my mother had threatened my brother that if he continued to cry, she was going to leave him in Hungary. So that was the story.
You're right. Funny, yet slightly sad.
Yep.
Wow.
That was pretty much my upbringing, funny yet slightly sad. Some of it was funny and very sad, but...
Were there any times where it was just funny? Because we should end this interview on a good note.
Let's see. funny. I've got a lot of funny stories from that time, but I'm not remembering them right off the bat. Let me see. This, I'll give you two stories from school.
All right.
One of which is not so funny, and the other one is sort of funny. But when we're at the French Lycée, they have the vice principal is actually called Monsieur le Censeur, and or Madame la Censeuse, and it actually means the rule enforcer. And and so. One day, this is during our first year in school, I got called out of class. And you have to understand, I don't speak French.
At the time.
At the time, I don't speak French. And so they call me out, and I'm going, "What did I do? What did I do?" Right? And I'm being led down these halls. I have no idea where I'm going. Right? And then they open the door to Monsieur le Censeur, and I know somebody's about to get disciplined for something, and I am a part of it. And I have no idea why. And I'm sat down in the anteroom in front of his secretary. And then my brother comes in.
Oh boy.
And I look at him, and he's got this little grin on his face. And I said, "What did you do?" And he said, "Well, there might have been something that happened on the playground." I said, "What did you do?" He said, "I bit a girl." Oh. I said, "What?" So they pulled us in. They pulled us in, and the supervising teacher came in. The teacher who was supervising the recess, she quickly singled out my brother, and I was excused, and I could go back. Another time, this is actually later.
He probably got in a lot of trouble for that one.
He got into trouble for that, yeah. I didn't. But I almost did, because they didn't know which Waddles it was who'd done it. And so it was one of the American Waddleses. I don't know which one. So.
And then the supervising teacher came in and she was like, that one.
That one, right. But then another time, this was actually after we'd learned French and German and the whole thing. My parents gave me a transistor radio for my birthday. A transistor radio. Transistor radios at that time were like very rare. And this was this big. You know, it was a Zenith and it was this big. It was about, you know, 9 inches tall and 3 inches thick and had a little speaker in it, you know, and a little headphone. You could get a headphone and you could listen to it through the headphone. It was very, very cool and very advanced. And you could get radio programs, listen to music, and had a little antenna, you know, and it had a little stand.
That sounds awesome.
Had a little stand that it sat on, you know, that folded out from it, you know, and I'm like, oh, this is a great gift. I love it. And I took it to school once.
Oh.
Right? And we were at recess, and we were, you know, I'm going, am I cool or what? You know, my friends are listening to the radio. They're going, this is really great. This is fine. The supervising teacher comes up to us and says, Monsieur Vatless, ce radio est confisqué. I am confiscating your radio. I'm taking it. And she went on to say, at the end of the day, you can go to Monsieur Le Censeur and get it back. So I'm kind of upset. But I think, all right, fine, I'll pick it up at the end of the day. No
Sounds
big
like
deal.
The time
I wasn't going to listen to it in class anyway.
Sounds like the time when a substitute took my cards. Cards helped me focus in class.
So I went to the, although the radio wasn't helping me focus, it was just making me more popular. I went to see Monsieur Le Censeur at the end of the day, went to his office. The secretary says, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here to pick up my radio. She says, oh yes, 1 minute. And then she buzzes Monsieur Le Censeur. And when I go into Monsieur Le Censeur's office to pick up the radio.
He's listening to it?
Yep. So anyway, that's my funny story.
That is a good story. On that note, I think we will end this interview because I pretty much asked all the questions. So, yeah. Alrighty.
One of the things about Vienna.
So I missed a question.
You missed a question, yes. So this was, what was it like? What other things did you see in Vienna that reminded you of the war? And
this was
part of our learning was, we had a family that we knew pretty well called the Fishers. They were also a diplomatic family, and we played with them a lot because they had kids our age and
they spoke English.
And they spoke English. And so they had a big house in Vienna. We lived in an apartment, but they had a big house. And it was a little bit on the outskirts. And we went to the, but it still was within the city. And we went to the house, and I remember going there, and I remember them saying, we need to show you these places, these hiding places. And they took us along a corridor on the second floor.
It was one of the hiding places during the Holocaust.
During the time of the occupation when the Jews were being hauled away.
The Holocaust.
Yeah, which eventually became the Holocaust. They pulled out a bookcase. Just pulled it out from the wall. It was on wheels.
Like the one that we have up there.
And right. And then behind it was a corridor. And you could go down that corridor, and at the end of that corridor was a room. And it was a place where this is a house that sheltered Jews, and they had built this in order to hide. And then they said, oh, but this is even cooler. They took us up to the attic. and you walked, you know, the attic had these sloping roofs that come down, right? And you walked along and you counted beams. You counted the beams, the trusses on the roof. You go 1, 2, 3. And between the third and the fourth truss, you take your fist and you bang it at the bottom of the roof, at the bottom of this interior thing for the attic, and this trap door would fly up. And you had to get on your hands and knees to crawl in. But there was a room there, and there was a trunk that had dried peas in it. So people were eating there, you know. I mean, that's where they lived. So this was all part of the mystery of being in a city that had been occupied and where people had to hide from the authorities.
Wow. That trap door, though, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was counterweighted.
Yeah.
It was held into place by friction, but when you hit it, it would fly right up. And it was a very clever hiding space. I mean, we went outside to look, and we went, there's no way you could tell. It looks like the roof is the same angle, but it wasn't. You know, same angle inside and out.
That is a really cool story. My history teacher is gonna love that.
So,
We also found in a drawer in our apartment, we found some banknotes that had been printed in the United States, but they were Viennese banknotes. They were Austrian banknotes printed in the United States, and I thought we found counterfeit money. I was really, I at the time I was reading the Hardy Boys and all kinds of mysteries, and I thought the people who had this apartment before us were counterfeiters, and it was all the more interesting because they were hidden in a secret drawer inside that you had to unlatch. That was inside it was inside another drawer, and then you unlatched it, and then there was another drawer, and that second drawer had these banknotes, and I went, wow, we found this stuff. And we, for a long time, my brother and I were, very excited about this and felt we'd found something, until it was explained to us by my stepfather that, in fact, after the war, the U.S. did a lot of things for the countries that they were occupying, or not occupying, but the countries they had liberated, and one of them was the Treasury Department printed Viennese.
Austrian money,
right.
They printed money.
Right.
Which makes sense, right? Because, after the war, their whole government was probably
in a shambles, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that's it.
That's interesting. Well, on that note, we're almost at the time up. We were supposed to be done like 15 minutes ago.
Okay.
But this has been really interesting, so I didn't want to stop it. So, thank you.
Thank you.
This is really interesting.